Morning. I'm reading from Mark 6, verse 30 to 56. And in the church Bibles, it's on page 1009. The apostles gathered round Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's already very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat." But he answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." When they found out, they said, "Five and two fish." Then Jesus told them to make all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties. Taking the five loaves and the two fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the two fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of the men who had eaten was 5,000. Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida, where he dismissed the crowd. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on the land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars, because the wind was against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass them by, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. They ran throughout that whole region and carried those who were ill on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went into villages, towns, or countrysides, they placed those who were ill in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched it were healed.
Thank you very much, Anna Marie. Well, two meals stand out to me about the time that I was getting married. The first is, of course, our wedding breakfast. It was fantastic to have good friends all around us with some of our favourite food, favourite drink, and favourite music there to celebrate as well. A memorable meal. The other meal was memorable, but for all the wrong reasons, and came the day after. We were on our way to our honeymoon and spent the entire day cramped into a hot and smelly train all the way down to Cornwall. We were tired, grumpy, sweaty, and what's more, the shopping that we'd ordered to arrive at the cottage didn't turn up. There were no shops open. It was a Sunday afternoon. There were no takeaways, and we were without food. We were reduced to scraping together some of the crumbs of some stale wedding cake that had been crushed at the bottom of our bag to try and make a meal out of it. It was quite an introduction to married life. Thankfully, things have got better since then. But in Mark 6, we come across another two meals which form another contrast. One meal we actually saw last week with Herod and his big birthday banquet. The elite gather together for a big party. That sounds fantastic. The celebs are there, the wine is flowing, there's dancing, music, and more. It promises a great deal. But there's a contrast to a meal that we see today. We need to head out into the desert for our first feeding in the wilderness. Our first heading this morning is the feeding in the wilderness. The 12 apostles gather and return in verse 30 from sharing the good news in the villages. You might remember we saw them sent out last week, and they report back to Jesus all that they'd done and taught. Presumably, some houses had rejected them and they'd had to move on. But other seed has fallen on good soil and has produced a crop some 30, some 60, some 100 times what was sown. So much so that they really can't deal with it all. So many people were coming and going that they didn't even have chance to eat. For a parallel, imagine some of the scenes that we've seen in India just this last week of doctors and nurses so busy, so ran off their feet that there's no time to take a break, no time to even eat. It's a problem that we've met before in Mark chapter 3, where Jesus' family think that he's gone out of his mind. Jesus realizes the problem and proposes a solution. Verse 31. Come with me by yourselves. Come to a quiet place and let's get some rest. There's quite a lot going on in that statement. Notice Jesus' compassion for his disciples. They've had a hard time and they need a break. He's no slave driver. He places a good deal of importance on rest. And that's a fine lesson for us to learn as well. We are human and we need a break. But he doesn't take them off to the nearest spa or just sit them down in front of the TV for a while. For them, rest means spending time with Jesus. Time spent with Jesus refreshes in a more refreshing way than even the best of jacuzzis can. I can understand why people might say, wouldn't it be nice to have a lie-in on a Sunday morning sometime? But I can never wholly agree with it. You'd be taking a rest from something which is actually even more restful, something that'll help you to rest throughout the entire week. But as we all know, some problems you just can't get away from. Some problems run around the lake ahead of us and try and head us off. Verse 33, but many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw the large crowd, he had compassion on them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. Jesus' response here is astonishing. He'd be well within his rights to shoo them away and say, guys, we haven't had a break for a long time, just give us a rest. But instead, he rolls up his sleeves and tends to their need. Just think about that for the moment. Jesus is never too busy when we come to him. We never come to Jesus to find him on holiday. Our prayers don't sit in his inbox until he gets back to work. He sees our need and acts in compassion. And again, there's a lot there in those verses. They're described as being like sheep without a shepherd. That doesn't mean that they're all cuddly and cute and that Jesus just swoops them up and gives them a hug. What we might not see straight away is that that's really talking about leadership. They were some people who needed to be led and directed. Numbers 27:17, Moses had prayed for someone who would lead them, who would lead them out and bring them in so that the Lord's people would not be like sheep without a shepherd. Israel's kings and Israel's leaders are often described as the shepherd of the sheep. And that makes this a deliberate snipe at Israel's current leaders, King Herod and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Those who ought to be caring for the flock are too busy with birthday parties, too busy feeding their own faces to bother feeding the sheep. By contrast, Jesus is the good shepherd. He gives up his food. He gives up his rest so that the sheep can find their food, so that they can find their rest. He begins by teaching them many things. That is what leaderless sheep need. They need teaching. Jesus leads, Jesus cares by teaching them. And the same is true today. Of course, we care deeply for people's physical needs and should be at work to help them in that. But the greatest thing that we can do for people, the most compassionate thing that we can do for friends and the world around us, is to share with them the good news of Jesus, to teach them about him. Man does not live by bread alone, but every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Jesus teaches them many things, so much so that it makes a new problem, the problem of hunger. Before, it was the disciples that couldn't eat, and now it's the crowd in verse 35. By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. "This is a remote place," they said, "and it's getting very late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and village and buy themselves something to eat." Survival programs make it look so easy, don't they? You just forage for these nuts and berries, just catch yourself a rabbit and cook it, and you'll be fine. But as a matter of fact, I hear that it's actually a lot harder than they make it sound. One of my friends once went on a survival week in Croatia. I think they sort of stayed in a ruined cottage and had to hunt for themselves. And he thought it'll be fine. A week of barbecues on the beach with fresh fish and lovely herbs as well. But just 2 days in, for all his splashing about in the surf, he'd caught no fish. And actually, his foraging had given him a horrible tummy. And so he made a quick and hasty retreat back to the nearest McDonald's, back to civilization. And that's just one person. Imagine trying to forage for 5,000 people. It would be impossible. There's no convenient Morrison's to go to. And Mark highlights how unlikely a human remedy is going to be. 37. Jesus answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." Then, when they found out, they said, "Well, we have 5 loaves and we have 2 fish." That's not really enough to feed 5,000 people, is it? Even at minimum wage, about half a year's wage is £9,000. Can you imagine spending that much just on bread? There is no human help for this problem. People are going hungry, and so Jesus steps in. He tells them all, "Sit down in groups on the green grass." Might make you think of Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures." They literally recline like sheep on the green grass, and the Lord feeds them. Verse 41. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks, broke the loaves, and gave it to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the 2 fish among them, and they all ate and were satisfied. We're not told quite how it multiplied. Did a huge pile appear suddenly behind Jesus? Or was it like Elijah's jar of flour that just kept on filling up, more and more just coming out from these baskets as they took it out? Either way, Jesus provides more than just a snack, more than just a putter-oner until they can get home. When Jesus feeds his people, they are completely stuffed if we can put it that way. The kind of feeling that you get after a good Christmas dinner. They eat to satisfaction, and more, there's more left behind than there was at the beginning. The disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. And that brings us back to our contrast between Herod and Jesus. What sort of a host does each of them make? If this was come dine with me, who would you rather go and visit? Herod's party is promising, but turns out to be a bust. Yes, the elite are there, the military commanders and leading men of Galilee, but the likes of you and I, we wouldn't get a look in. Whereas Jesus' party has an open door. There's 5,000 men there, and other gospel writers would say, women and children beside. Herod's party has dancing, yes, but also a crowd of men devouring a young girl with their eyes. Whereas Jesus' party is all compassion and care. King Herod might be one of the lads, but is a spineless leader, pushed around by his wife and friends. Jesus has backbone. He's the leader that they need. For food, Herod serves up the head of John the Baptist on a platter. Jesus serves up bread and fish that fully satisfies. It's a striking contrast with a contemporary ring to it. If you were to look out of your front window and think of the street just around you and the people in it, they would well be described as being like sheep without a shepherd. Everyone out there is looking for someone who will lead them to green pastures, but very often falling in with false leaders and bad shepherds like King Herod. You can hear the echoes of Herod's party all around us. Our society is narrow. It's made up of those who are in and those who are out. Self-interest reigns, leading to many young women being exploited. Spineless leaders sell their ideals to save their own necks, and people are chewed up and spat out at an alarming rate. A really important lesson for us as a church is to not get cynical, not just get frustrated or angry, not just to retreat into our little Christian bubble, but to have compassion on them, to draw alongside them and offer them something better. There's a real hunger at the moment for leaders who are authentic, who actually have convictions, leaders who feed their followers, not just their own faces. A leader who will guide us to green pastures, even lay down his life for the sheep. And that, of course, is what we have. The feeding of the 5,000, of course, points forward to a meal later on in Mark's gospel, where he shares another loaf with his disciples in preparation for his death. Mark 14:22. While they were eating, Jesus took the bread, and when he'd given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it. This is my body." Jesus gave his body on the cross in our place. Don't you wonder, leader, who would do that for you? A king who would die because he loved you. Isn't that a better party to attend? But as we read the story, you might have been sat there thinking, hold on, I've heard this somewhere before. So let's move on to our second feeding in the wilderness, or feeding in the wilderness again. Or is it really our first? Because if we turn back to Exodus, we find a startling amount of similarities. Get ready to do some page turning for a little while. We'll be hopping around Exodus. You can find the first one on page 92 in the church Bibles. If you've not got one of them, if you're in your own, it's the second book in the Bible, fairly early on. Israel are in slavery in Egypt, and Exodus is the story of how God brings his people out and takes them to the promised land. We're going to start in Exodus chapter 33, where God promises that he will be with his people and that he will take them from Egypt to the promised land of rest. Verse 14, the Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." And that gets you thinking of the disciples, doesn't it? Doesn't Jesus take them out to find rest? On to Exodus 13 verse 18, page 71. So God led the people around by the desert road towards the Red Sea. That's somewhat disguised in our translation. Our translation says that Mark takes his people out to a solitary place. He mentions that three times, but it could actually be translated as he takes them out to the desert or the wilderness, just like God taking his people out of Egypt and through the desert or through the wilderness. Here's some more. Exodus 34, verse 6. God is described as a God of compassion. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness. Does that sound familiar? Remind you of another compassionate person? Jesus gets the people to sit down in hundreds and fifties, perhaps like Moses had arranged the tribes by thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens in 1824. 16:4, if that wasn't enough, then the Lord said to Moses, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. Part of Israel's identity, one of their defining moments, was when God had provided bread for them in the desert. As they'd walk through, he provides manna from on high. It can't be a coincidence then that Jesus is again in the desert and is again providing bread. I wonder if you've got the point yet. If you don't, then don't worry. Mark goes on again. Back in Mark chapter 6, Jesus sends his disciples away. He sends the crowd away. He goes up on a mountain and he prays. And then in verse 47, later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake with the disciples in it, and he was alone on the land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Then he walks out to meet them. You maybe saw 10 years ago there was a viral video of some runners claiming to be able to run on water. If you were to watch the video, they ran for about 15 steps before slowly sinking below the water. But it turns out that it was a hoax. Of course it was. It was just an advert for some waterproof running shoes. The making of video shows a nice platform underneath the water that they ran on and then ran off. More recently, Dynamo tried to do that on the Thames, didn't he? But that sort of hoax would be impossible for Jesus. People come up with the most absurd of theories to try and explain it away. Is he on a sandbank? Well, no, not really. He's in the middle of the lake. Is he on ice? Well, no, he's not Elsa. He's not freezing the lake in front of him. Is he on the shore? Well, no, not if he gets into the boat in the middle of the lake. More of these theories are more far-fetched than Jesus actually walking on water. Verse 47. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass them by. But when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. He cried out because all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. Notice how Mark has shut down the ghost or the hallucination theory. A very physical Jesus gets into the boat with them. But to summarize, Jesus passes by, walking on water, saying, "I am, it is I." And again, you might be thinking, well, I've heard that somewhere before. Who is it who walks on water in the Old Testament? Well, it's God. And God alone. Job 9:8. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. Who is it who passes by in glory? Well, it's God again, isn't it? Exodus 33, we read earlier on. Moses asks to see God's glory, and so he's put in a cleft between the rocks, and God's glory passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God. Who is it who declares, "I am"? Again, it's God. Exodus 3:14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. There's a lot of threads here tying Exodus back to Mark 6. One commentator even tries and ties the wind direction back to a passage in Exodus, which may be a little bit far-fetched, but you can see his point. What Mark's wanting to do is to hang these two stories side by side so that we come to a deeper and a richer understanding of what Jesus is doing. This isn't just teaching us that Jesus is God. We've seen that before in Mark. What this is teaching us is that Jesus is this God. Jesus is the God of the Exodus. The same God who saved people from slavery to Egypt. He acts with the same power and is moved by the same compassion. Exodus 3:7, the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard their crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned. I care for their suffering, so I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up to a land, a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Jesus and his ministry don't just pop up out of nowhere. Jesus isn't just here to feed a few mouths or to showboat by walking on water. Jesus is here to do another Exodus. It's as if he says, I've indeed seen the misery of my people. I've heard their crying out because of their slavery, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from their leaders and bring them up to a good land, a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. We can sometimes shrink Jesus' work down to, Jesus died to save me from my sins. And he did. Of course he did. That's wonderfully true. Never let go of that. But we also need to acknowledge that he spends around 2,000 years of history getting us ready to see that. Jesus is here to do more than just feed the poor and heal the sick. He's here to do more than just help individuals with their individual problems. He's here to rescue a people from slavery. He's here to feed them in the wilderness. He's here to lead them to the land of promise, to the new creation. And Mark gives us two responses to that. The disciples are somewhat disappointing. As you go through Mark, you begin to lose sympathy for the disciples. Back in Mark 4, where they're in the storm with Jesus, Jesus warns them, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? And you might think, well, you know, that's a bit harsh, isn't it, Jesus? It is hard to get your head around one of your friends turning out to be God. And yet here they are again, terrified. They thought he was a ghost. They still have no faith. And worse than that, they are hard-hearted. Verse 52, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. If you remember back to chapter 3 and the healing of the man with the crippled hand on the Sabbath, that puts Jesus' friends on a par with his enemies, with the Pharisees and the Herodians who'd plotted to kill him. And worse than that, given the links back to Exodus, it puts them on a par with Pharaoh, the villain of Exodus, whose hard heart had resisted God and his plans in the face of overwhelming evidence. At this point, the disciples are very clearly outsiders. And it'll get still worse in another sea crossing on chapter 8. The evidence is there for them to see, but they just don't see it. They just don't get it. And perhaps that's been you. As we've followed through Mark so far, perhaps you just don't get it. There is a warning here. The problem might not be with the transmitter, it might be with the receiver. The evidence is very clear. And if you don't see it, the problem might not be that you're just blind, but that you simply don't want to see. That you've hardened your heart and are refusing Jesus. And yet even here we see Jesus' compassion. He doesn't give up on them, but keeps on teaching them. He calms the storm again. Then he calms them down. Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid. He patiently and graciously extends that teaching process. He's not resentful, he's not grumpy, he is generous. In fact, we might say he's the Lord, the gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. But the response we are looking for, we find in Gennesaret, verse 53. When they'd crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. They ran through the whole region and carried all those who were ill on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, in the villages or the towns or the countryside, they placed all those who were ill in marketplace. They begged him to let them touch even just the edge of his cloak. And all who touched it were healed. Just like the crowd in verse 33, they recognize who Jesus was and they run to him. There's a desperation there that draws near to Jesus, but also a recognition that reaches out to him. Like Jairus, they beg for help. Like the woman who'd been bleeding, they think, well, if I just touch his clothes, then I'll be healed. And all who touch him are healed. Or that could equally say, all who touch him are saved. The question is, do you recognize as they did? Who is he to you? Is he just a teacher? Do you recognize him as God, as a powerful being? Is he a mighty healer? Or is he more? Is he the God of the Exodus? Is he the Good Shepherd? Is he the King? Is he your leader and king, the one who'll lead you safely to green pastures, safely to the promised land?